Tonight is Rosh Chodesh Kislev. So what that means is it's the new moon. It's the start of the new month. You know, in the Hebrew calendar, the months are actually tied to the lunar cycle. So you want to know what time of the month it is, all you have to do is look in the sky, if it's a clear night, and see what the moon looks like, and then you'll know what time of the month it is. So the Torah tells us on Rosh Chodesh to offer certain sacrifices, special sacrifices on Rosh Chodesh. Just like on Shabbat, there's additional sacrifices. On the holidays, there's additional sacrifices. On Rosh Chodesh, there's additional sacrifices. But one of those sacrifices is different from all the other holidays because it is a sin offering. It's a sin offering. But what's unique about it is it says it's a sin offering for the Lord. None of the other holidays does it say this offering is for the Lord. But it's a sin offering for the Lord. And what that hints to us is that Rosh Chodesh is a time of reconciliation. What do we do on Rosh Chodesh? Oh, we sing the Hallel Psalms. We don't fast. And here at Beth Emmanuel, as you might know, a custom has arisen among some families to eat pizza on Rosh Chodesh. It's a great idea. I'm 100% in favor of eating pizza on Rosh Chodesh. But it's not a long-standing Jewish tradition. You need to know that. You might hear a lot about pizza, Rosh Chodesh pizza. That's a special Beth Emmanuel thing, not widespread Jewish tradition. Actually, a more widespread American Jewish tradition is to eat pizza on Saturday night after Shabbat is over. The pizza places start up, and you can order pizza in the kosher. If you got a kosher pizza place nearby. But around here, we have to stick to our handmade pizzas and do it once a month. So let me try some. Do we have any kids here? Any kids? Yeah. Some kids. By the way, if kids get restless as I'm talking, there's not a special kids class, but Mr. Hughes is way upstairs in the classroom, and he'll read stories with the kids if they get rowdy. Okay? So kids are welcome to stay down here. They're welcome to go up there if they can't sit still, and that's fine. But all right, kids that are here, I got a question for you. What if somebody came to you and said, guess what? I've got good news. Rosh Chodesh is canceled. There's no more Rosh Chodesh ever again. And not only that, no more Shabbat, no more holidays. They've all been canceled. It's good news. No Sukkah. No Passover Seder. Isn't that great news?
No!
Would you be happy about that?
No!
You wouldn't be happy. Would you think of me as a Jewish version of this guy? Yeah. That would be what your reaction would be, I'm sure. So, strangely, people who have never kept the Shabbat, have never kept Rosh Chodesh or the holidays, think that canceling them would be really good news. So it's really kind of a strange way of thinking. But it's just what happens if you never have grown up experiencing it. Now, Paul is accused, the New Testament writer, the apostle, is accused of teaching that the Torah's commands, especially the dietary laws and calendar observances, are not incumbent upon a follower of Yeshua, whether the Jewish or Gentile. However, you know, when you misunderstand where Paul's coming from, it will lead to a dramatically incorrect reading and understanding. And that's the problem. Paul can be confusing sometimes. But especially if you start off with the wrong assumption. I find that if you come to Paul and you assume that he is pro-Torah, and he's observant, he's promoting the only religion he has ever known, and that's Judaism, if you start off with that assumption, then you will find that his teachings are brilliant, and they encourage us to pursue the Torah ourselves with joy. So there's a passage from Colossians. It's a really perfect example of the way Paul gets misunderstood. Take a look at it. Therefore, let no one pass judgment on you in questions of food and drink, whether with regard to a festival or a new moon or a Sabbath. These are a shadow of the things to come, but the substance belongs to Christ. It's Colossians 2, 16 to 17. Have you heard this passage? Have you heard it taught to mean that the holidays, the dietary laws, Shabbat, it's all over with? So according to conventional Christian interpretations of this passage, Paul's advising the Colossians to stand up against anybody who says that the Torah's laws about food and the Torah's laws about Shabbat and holidays should still be instructed and observed. If you look at the ESV Study Bible, it tells us Christians are, this is a comment, ESV's Study Bible's commentary on this verse, it says, Christians are no longer obligated to observe Old Testament dietary laws. That's the food and drink. Or festivals, holidays, special days, and that's what it means by a festival, a new moon, a Sabbath. For what these things foreshadowed has been fulfilled in Christ. That's the summary from the ESV commentator's perspective of what Paul's getting at in this passage. All right, I have a question. Let's just table that for a second and imagine what would happen if at the end of his term as president, Barack Obama stood up and said, and I'm not going to try to do an impersonation of him, but over the course of these past 8 years, I have fulfilled every aspect of the Constitution of the United States perfectly. And now that the Constitution is fulfilled, its authority over this nation has been put to an end in me. Today I tell you that the United States has only one law, that you love one another. I mean, first of all, the situation is absurd. Why is it absurd, though? It's because every good president fulfills the Constitution. I mean, that just means that they properly execute what it says and means. Doing a good job at that does not entitle a president to any special status or claim or reward. In fact, if he didn't do that, he could be prosecuted or impeached, right? Secondly, the Constitution's not a problem waiting for a solution. We're not waiting for someone to solve the Constitution. It doesn't, and there's nowhere in the Constitution where it includes a clause that says, if someone manages to keep the Constitution perfectly, then it no longer applies anymore. There's no line in there that says that, is there? One person being constitutionally faithful does not give other people the right to be unconstitutional. Right? And third, the Constitution is the foundation for the entire legal system of the United States. Without the Constitution, there is no basis for law in this country at all. In fact, without the Constitution, there would actually be no such thing as a president, because the Constitution sets in place the framework for defining that term. There would be no... The president's authority, in other words, is derived from the Constitution. If the president canceled the Constitution, he would then be nullifying his own authority in his own office, because it's the Constitution that gives him that. Furthermore, if the Constitution, and then by extension, all of the legislation that's founded on the Constitution, were to be canceled, what would happen to our nation? It would cease to exist. It would no longer be a legal body whatsoever. There would be no boundaries. There would be no definitions. There would be no such thing as the United States of America if there were no Constitution. So, of course, seeing these disastrous consequences, people naturally rise up to defend the Constitution whenever they perceive that it's in jeopardy. And sometimes with very religious patriotism. And that's a good thing. That's appropriate. Right? So, what about the constitution of the Jewish nation? To some Christians, the Torah served a limited purpose. The purpose of the Torah was to reveal the Messiah, his identity, his mission, and our need for him. And once it's served that purpose, people would say, it's little more than a relic of the ancient past. I've even heard some Christians say that even by attempting to observe the Torah's laws, one becomes an enemy of the cross. Have you heard that? Now, I'm not trying to mock or ridicule Christians or Christianity, just to register my disagreement with that position and the point of view that is shared by some Christians. But this perspective on the Torah has exactly the same problems that the hypothetical situation I posed to you with the Constitution. Yeah, the Torah teaches us about the Messiah, just like the Constitution teaches us about the president and the executive branch of the government. But anyone who legitimately claimed the office of Messiah would have to be rigorously observant of the Torah and uphold it. They would have to see to it that the Constitution is properly interpreted and properly enforced. And that's a central part of the Messiah's job. Just as it's the job of all judges, it's the job of all rulers and all kings provided for in the Torah itself. So any officer who fulfills the Torah in this way is just doing their job. If they don't fulfill the Torah, they are considered wicked. Likewise, the Torah does not include any provision that one may cancel it by keeping every law. So there's no mechanism by which one person keeping the Torah perfectly alleviates everyone else from having to keep it. I mean, sure, there's this there's this concept in the Torah of what's called arvut. It's a mutual responsibility for one another. Yeah, we're responsible for each other. And that's the righteousness of some people or the wickedness of some people have an effect on the unity of the effect on the whole community because of the unity of the people. But still, each individual is responsible for his own observance of the Torah. So Moses' righteousness, for example. Moses' righteousness put him in a position to attain mercy from God after the sin of the golden calf. However, even though Moses attained forgiveness for the people, that didn't mean that the people had have no responsibility to be obedient themselves. But does this metaphor of the Torah and the Constitution, does this metaphor of the Constitution for the Torah, does that really apply? Actually, I think it is probably one of the best comparisons available to us in modern times for the Torah. And that's where I think most of the misunderstanding comes in. People think of the Torah as a guidebook to life, a book of inspirational quotes. They see it as having a doctrinal purpose, an educational purpose. And even some people who are Torah observant just think of it as God's instructions for life. Just here's what you do. But that isn't actually the context in which the Torah itself was given. The primary role that the legal component of the Torah played in ancient Israel was that of the foundation of government. The foundation of a nation. The ancient Israelites had judicial courts. Jewish people today also have judicial courts, Bate Din. They didn't, as some folks imagine, execute some sort of savage vigilante system where people threw rocks at each other. That's what some people imagine went on in Bible times. No, they had a foundational legal document, the Torah, and they built on that on that foundation, just like governments do today, through legislators, through case precedent, through courts of judges. And that process is continuing even today in the Jewish nation. Now, even in the land of Israel, the Torah was essential for maintaining and preserving the Jewish national identity. Right? Just like I said, if the Constitution were to be abolished, the United States would be abolished. When the Jewish people were removed from the land of Israel, the Torah was the only thing holding them together. It became more essential than ever to preserving Jewish identity. Through God's gift of the Torah, the Jewish people still managed to be a distinct nation, even outside of physical borders. Now today, what does it mean to be Jewish? Being Jewish is not a race. Jewish is not a race, it's not a culture. It never was. It's a nationality. That's the best way to understand what Jewishness is. It's a nationality. So there are genetic similarities in certain groups of Jewish people. Yeah. There are common languages among Jewish people. Yes. There are other cultural or ethnic features that can be found among Jewish groups. But these are byproducts of a people bound together by a common national identity. So don't get me wrong. There is a genetic, or really better understood as a hereditary component. God made Abraham's seed, his offspring, into the nation of Israel. But it's not about DNA, as if people in Bible times even knew what that was. It's about the nation. God said to Abraham, I will make you a great nation. And part of that national system is that citizenship is passed on from parents to children. Furthermore, citizens are discouraged from marrying non-citizens, right? So apart from occasional conversion, there is naturally a cohesive genetic component to Jewish identity. But God did not make Abraham into a race, which is, he didn't make him into Abraham into an ethnicity. I will make you into a great ethnicity. That's not what he did. He made Abraham into a nation, and that nation consists of the Jewish people globally. I'm not talking about the modern state of Israel here. So this nation, the nation of the Jewish people, has a legal foundation, just like America has a legal foundation, and that legal foundation is the Torah itself. But what if someone were to ask the Jewish people, to tell the Jewish people, you need to give up the Torah? If the Jewish people were to give up the Torah as a whole, the Jewish nation would lose all definition. It would be absorbed into all the surrounding nations, God forbid. There would be nowhere you could point to and say, those are Jewish people. The cultural and the genetic and the linguistic ties, they just dissipate through assimilation. So when Christianity demands of Israel that they give up the Torah, they're asking them to give up their God-given national identity. That's, in other words, they're asking, they don't realize it, but they're asking for national suicide. So in a way, rejection of Torah observance among Jewish people is doctrinally and fundamentally, are functionally, an anti-Semitic position, albeit indirectly and unintentionally. It's not that they hate Jewish people, but the theology itself is destructive to the Jewish nation, and in that sense, it's anti-Semitic. So I just find it ironic. Have you ever noticed this? That many of the same people who declare the Torah to be obsolete are also really ardent supporters of the U.S. Constitution. Isn't that kind of strange? It's hypocritical, isn't it, to demand that Israel's constitution has to be abolished and to be replaced by a few ethical sentiments, while at the same time you're really devoted to the preservation of your own secular nation's legal framework. So how can Christians keep and enforce the laws of secular governments, which are really just the products of human reasoning, maybe very smart human reasoning, while at the same time abolishing the legal system that was established by God. I mean, which of these two, between the Torah and the U.S. Constitution, both great documents, which of them is more enduring, more righteous, more profound, more true? But as the claim goes, what these things foreshadowed has been fulfilled in Christ. That's what the commentators say. But this explanation really raises a difficulty, in my opinion. How is it that they are a shadow of Messiah, a reason not to observe them? Most of the time we actually create holidays specifically to symbolize and commemorate events after the fact, right? I mean, today is Veterans Day. Do we have any veterans here today? We have a, all right. Let's just give, say thank you, right? Thank you for serving this country. But how ludicrous would it be to say that Veterans Day is obsolete because we have actual veterans? That doesn't even make any sense. How much more appropriate is it if we have veterans present to take the time and observe the day and to say thank you? I mean, that's why Veterans Day was instituted, because we have veterans, right? So as for the Colossians, to summarize that, so the holidays foreshadow the Messiah. They commemorate the Messiah. They remember the Messiah. They demonstrate, they symbolize Messiah. So we have Messiah, so then we just give up the holidays? That's not how holidays work. That's not even what they're for, is it? Okay. As for the Colossians, here's my question. What are they supposed to do now that all their holidays are pointless? I mean, are they better off with no holidays? They're supposed to go from one day to the next, have no holidays. Or what are they supposed to, I guess we'll just go with the Roman holidays, the idolatrous pagan holidays, I guess. That's all we have left. Is that somehow, they have no connection to the Messiah, so I guess they're not obsolete anymore. Or they're not obsolete, like these ones. Is that better? Is that what they're... So, okay. That's confusing, but what's even more confusing is this. Rosh Chodesh. So Paul in Colossians says, don't let anyone judge you about the new moon. All right, well, the new moon is a semi-festive a holiday in Judaism, right? Because of that idea of atonement, where we're reconciliation to God. It's great. It's a holiday. It's a happy day. We eat pizza, right? Or whatever. There's no requirement to abstain from work. You don't have to take the day off. You know, it's not like Shabbat and festivals. I mean, okay, so we have some additional prayers. We say the Hallel, Psalms. I mean, the only real requirement of Rosh Chodesh is you don't fast. Don't you dare fast. This is Rosh Chodesh. All right? So how do you criticize someone for being legalistic, for observing Rosh Chodesh? Have you thought about that? What are they doing that's so oppressive and under the law on Rosh Chodesh? Are they eating pizza? Don't eat that pizza! That's legalistic! Is the problem that they just knew what day of the month it was? Or they turned the page on their calendar? What is it about Rosh Chodesh? How does that even make sense that they're being legalistic about Rosh Chodesh? How does that even make sense? I mean, in the first century, there was no alternative to the Jewish calendar and holiday cycle other than a pagan one. That's all there was. So now that the Colossians are Christians, well, they can't count the months by the Jewish calendar, so they should use the Roman one instead. I mean, Paul can't be advocating this, can he? So, okay, let's take a look at the context. It's pretty clear. It's about asceticism. Paul is criticizing the practice and ideology of asceticism. And asceticism is this belief that by denying oneself food and physical comforts, one is able to gain supernatural revelation. It's not really very common in the Western world today, but ascetic practices were actually at one time popular among certain segments of the Jewish community. Ascetic or ancient mystical literature describes how people would undertake these fasts, severe, lengthy fasts for days and days and days, and they'd assume a state of extreme ritual purity, and then they'd recite these secret sayings, and they'd utter odes and angelic names in order to catch a glimpse of the heavens. Now, mainstream Jewish thought appreciates the value of moderation, appreciates the value of fasting occasionally. But it does not require that kind of obsessive regimen of utter abstinence and utter isolation. God created the world for human enjoyment as an opportunity to give thanks and to praise Him. The Torah tells us, eat and be satisfied and bless the Lord. That's what we do with God's creation. God makes something enjoyable, we enjoy it, and we say thank you to God. Right? What do the sages say? The sages say that in the future, a person will need to give justification and accounting for all that his eye saw, but he did not eat. Can you imagine if Paul said that? People would think. If Paul said that, forget the kosher laws. But this is what the sages said in the Talmud. Of course, since we assume that the sages are pro Torah, they're not telling us that you have to be able to eat everything that's not kosher. They're saying that you stand before God and God says, why didn't you eat that pork? You say, because it's not kosher. And it's like, good job. Right? You gave an accounting. you stand before God, though, and there's this great, you had an apple or something like that. And why didn't you eat that? Well, because I thought I'd be holier if I didn't eat the apple. Eat the pizza, whatever, you know? That's the point. So why does Colossians mention Sabbath? Why does it mention Rosh Chodesh and the holidays? So these are times of festivity. These are times of delight, right? That's why we're not fasting today. Paul's ascetic opponents, they're ascetic, right? Paul's ascetic opponents criticized the Colossians for gathering like we are today to celebrate, to eat meat, to drink wine on the Sabbath and holidays instead of doing what ascetics do, which is quarantining themselves in self-abasement, which is a path that they perceived as more pious, more holy. So Paul's message to the Colossians was that they are not to let others judge them for enjoying food and drink and for celebrating and for delighting in the holidays according to the Torah and according to Jewish custom. Right? So the next verse says, these are a shadow of the things to come, but the substance belongs to Christ. So this doesn't mean that these holidays are now obsolete in the light of the knowledge of Messiah. This phrase, things to come, is reminiscent of this Hebrew phrase, atid lavo, which refers to the messianic kingdom that we still await. Things that are coming. Things in the ultimate messianic future. Judaism teaches that the Sabbath and the holidays are a foretaste of the world to come, which is a time of joy, a time of delight, a time of abundant prosperity, a time of ample food. That's what the Messianic kingdom is like, right? And we are inhabitants of that kingdom. We are looking forward to that kingdom. We are citizens of that kingdom. In what sense does the substance belong to Messiah? What does it mean? These are shadows, but Messiah is substance. Right? The Sabbath is a shadow. It's a foretaste of the world to come. Well, in contrast to the Sabbath and holidays, which just give us a small glimpse into that future world, our resurrected King, Yeshua, is an actual inhabitant of that world. He actually is from that world. He's made up of messianic kingdom stuff. The Sabbath gives us a little taste. Yeshua is the real thing. So how much? And so we are his disciples, and so we create this. We're members of his kingdom. We are. We constitute an enclave of the Messianic kingdom in this age, here and now. So where we are, that's where the kingdom is right now. We've got a stronghold right now, the Messianic kingdom. You go out there outside this building, and you're back in this world. But you're right here, right now, eating pizza. You're in the world to come. You're in the Messianic kingdom, right? So if we're in the Messianic kingdom right now, we should be eating pizza, because that's what the Messianic kingdom is like. Right? How much more sense should we be allowed to enjoy good food and drink and celebrate the Sabbath and festivals if we're members of the Messianic kingdom? Right? So the ascetics have nothing to say to us. So no wonder my kids' eyes twinkle when the Sabbath candles are lit. They're so excited about it, right? Because they're children of the Messianic kingdom. They see that, and it reminds them of what their home is like, what the Messianic kingdom is like. The Sabbath, the holidays, those are a taste of home for our children. So I'll tell you what, don't let anyone judge you for keeping Shabbat, for keeping Rosh Chodesh, for keeping the festivals. Don't let anyone judge you for conforming your life to the Torah. So maybe you're not Jewish. Maybe it wouldn't technically be a sin for you to go to work on Shabbat. Maybe you're not legally liable for the holidays. But who cares? If you're a disciple of Yeshua, then you're a child of the Messianic age. And that age is an age of entirely Shabbat rest.